Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. Kieran, how are you?
I'm good, Kevin, although Finley is slightly traumatised at present. Because we went out this morning for our early morning walk, and we came across a pheasant, and he was looking at the pheasant, and he was looking at me, and then because he's a setter, he decided to go on three legs and point at it, and that didn't get him very far. And I'm going, well, you know, you're supposed to be a working dog, and then he sort of started cowering behind my ankles. So I thought, what have I done here? I've got the world's most cowardly dumb dog.
Oh my lord, Uncle Terry would be so ashamed of him. Well, at least he pointed at it. He recognised it was a pheasant. Yes.
Yeah.
Kieran, I have to say, in the spirit of full disclosure, I am slightly hungover today.
Splendid.
Yes, some friends came round for an impromptu wake last night, and I knew that I must have had a lot to drink because I counted 12 post-it notes on various walls that said, record pod. Down the stairs and round, there's literally a trail of post-it note crumbs, record pod. So if I drift off at any stage, you'll understand why. But Finley, see, the trouble is you've spoilt Finley with the wonky chomps. And yet again, the BAFTA people have gone turned off. It's supposed to be about football finance. We've had a cowardly gun dog and a hungover host. It's questions day. It is questions day, Kieran, is it? Is it? I don't know.
I believe so.
Yes, okay. And we've got some great questions today, and also one of the most illogical questions we've ever had, which fits in with our pod perfectly, so which is why I'm really happy to read it out. Our first question comes from Michael Sicari. Michael says, given the recent Super League drama and how there always seem to be folks out there talking about the old firm joining the EPL, the English Premier League, I started to wonder, why don't some of the smaller leagues in Europe merge to create a mini Super League, specifically countries like Portugal, the Netherlands, Scotland, for example, which have strong fan bases, relatively wealthy populations and historic clubs. They all seem like they would benefit from a consolidation. Now, it's kind of happened already, Kieran, with the Netherlands, but this is the Atlantic League comes up twice a year, really, suggestions about the smaller countries, so-called, joining a different league, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And the most recent iteration of this was, I think this was being financed by an Irish billionaire. It was for I think it involved Scotland, Sweden, Denmark, Norway, and the Republic of Ireland to form some form of competition. And it hasn't been rejected out of hand. And we've also got, as you rightly mentioned, the so-called Benny League. Because as soon as you say that, I immediately think of Crossroads. and Tales of Miss Diane and sort of Mike Yarwood impersonations. So once again, we're locked in the 70s. But the danger, I think, from this scenario is that if we do take the Belgium and Netherlands combined league, which I think is the one which is furthest down the road, at present, Belgium and Netherlands have 10 clubs who get entries into UEFA competitions. And that can be really lucrative. If you take a look at Ajax's accounts for 2019, for example, 40% of Ajax's revenue came from participation in the Champions League. So under UEFA rules, no one country can have more than 7 participants. So if all of a sudden we're going from 10 to 7, in Belgium and the Netherlands, and then you've got Sweden, Denmark, Norway, Republic of Ireland and Scotland, if they are restricted to seven between them, some of those clubs who are not necessarily going to win things, but who sneak into the Conference League or the Europa League, or whatever it's going to be, they'll think, well, actually, financially, we're going to be worse off. So there is a lot to be said for these leagues. I think it would attract some interest. We don't know how much. And you know, especially towards the end of the season, you know, you could get some pretty spectacular matches. Whether that will turn into significant numbers in terms of viewing figures, we don't know. But there's no huge downside of it. If clubs want to perhaps initially start it off as a cup competition and then see if there's interest to perhaps move it on to something which is more of a league basis.
I suppose from a broadcaster's perspective, though, the trouble is that if you had countries like Scotland, Portugal merging, they're still going to be dominated by 2, 4, 6 teams, aren't they? You're still going to have Celtic, Rangers, Benfica, Sporting Lisbon pretty much dominating the whole thing. So the smaller teams in those countries probably wouldn't benefit that much from broadcasting anyway, would they?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right there. But if the overall value of the broadcasting pot increases, then those clubs could benefit financially. You know, what we have in Scottish football, and I think we discussed this on more than one occasion, is that we've got a duopoly. We've got something similar, perhaps in the Netherlands. Something, you know, there's two or three clubs in Portugal. And one of the good things about the Premier League is it's not particularly democratic, but it is more democratic in terms of the distribution of trophies than you see in the other big leagues. You know, Bayern have got a monopoly in Germany. You know, PSG win something every year in France. You know that Barcelona and Real Madrid are going to be in the top two or top three. Nearly every season until La Liga decided to curtail Barcelona's wage budget. It could be more interesting for a broadcaster because you're going to have more big matches.
For those of our younger listeners who can't be asked to Google Crossroads, it was a 5 nights a week soap opera set in Birmingham in a motel, which was spectacularly bad. And also baffling because it was the only motel in the country. There were no motels. It's simply, we're not a motel culture. No. But for some reason, there was a motel in Birmingham that attracted all sorts of drama and seemed to burn down on a semi-annual basis. but as a nine-year-old, Miss Diane, oh, my God.
I suspect Michael Terry was involved in the insurance claims at Crossroads.
Yeah, it was the first programme I ever saw in colour, bizarrely. I remember my mum being so excited to realise that the wallpaper was pink in the office drawing room where most of it was set. Again, the BAFTA people have gone. Any BAFTA person under the age of 60, out. Question from Josh Jehan. Josh says, I hope that's how you pronounce your surname, Josh. Josh Jehan says, do clubs get rewarded with prize money from the FA for getting promotion or winning the league in non-league football?
No, they don't get any prize money from the FA because the FA's remit is the England national team, but also cup competitions. So the winners of the FA Challenge Cup get £1.8 million. The winners of the FA Trophy get £60,000 and the FA Vase £30,000. When you go into the National League, whilst it does have sponsors, there doesn't appear to be any definitive prize money for winning it. I think there is money distributed between the clubs, but that seems to be on a fairly equitable basis. So, the benefits of promotion in non-league football is that you are going up a tier. You're able to attract bigger sponsors, you're able potentially to get larger crowds, and that's how you would see an increase in income. It doesn't seem to be anything specific from what I've seen in terms of prize money.
Is that all you get for the FA Trophy, £60,000?
Yeah, that's not too bad because you only get £200,000 for winning the League Cup. Could be worse.
Yeah, and I suppose for the level of team that are competing in the FA Trophy, that would be quite a lot of money. Yeah. Jeff Sullivan says, hello, Jeff. Is there any chance that ESPN would expand their coverage of the EFL 1 to 2 games a weekend, limited to a few top teams. Seems like a missed opportunity. I would love to follow a lower tier team and try to follow them to promotion glory. What would keep them from sharing all games? And Jeff, I think both of us would say, what would keep you from following a lower tier team that's not on TV? One that doesn't necessarily get promotion glory, because there's going to be a lot of listeners going, dear, really? You want to follow a lower tier team and follow them to glory? That's not how it works. I'll tell you what, Jeff, pick a terrible one and follow them all the way through to relegation. And
well, I think to be fair to the EFL, they do effectively have season passes for quite a few clubs. To allow fans who are based overseas to watch them under the iFollow scheme. From ESPN's point of view, the problem is that football, or soccer, as they prefer to miscall it, it generates okay viewing figures, but not great from the choices they already have. So the Premier League, the average viewing figures for the Premier League, 457,000. Yeah, America's a big country. For the MLS, it's 384. The most popular TV of football, TV viewing figures, or the highest TV viewing figures, are for Liga MX, because Mexican football, because America's got a very big Hispanic population, that tends to be most pretty popular. So once you have those, and then you throw in La Liga, and you throw in a bit of the Bundesliga as well, there's not many hours left for them to fill the airwaves. And what would be the viewing figures? If the Premier League can only get 500,000 people, what's Middlesbrough versus Luton going to get? Yeah. Because we don't tend to watch, for example. Yeah, there's decent-ish viewing figures by UK standards when we watch the NFL. But if you look at American college football, which does get decent figures in the US, nobody would tune into it over here. If we look at basketball, the NHL, you might watch it. I used to remember watching Grandstand growing up, and you'd sometimes watch the highlights, but that was from the Stanley Cup or something. But that's about as far as it went, and there was never enough critical mass to warrant the broadcasters investing any further in what we consider to be minority sports over here, and what in the US they consider to be a minority sport in the form of football.
Do you know, Kim, we had a review recently of this pod, a very nice review, and it mentioned the insight that people got into football. And I think that America is a big country, is a perfect example of the sort of insight we bring to our listeners.
Well, kids, yeah. £9,500 a year for higher education, you're getting your money's worth, aren't you?
There are people as well who say there was a reference to football being called soccer in about 1889 in this country. So there are Americans who say that soccer is actually the right phrase for it. They're wrong, of course. It's meant to be, what's the word? If I didn't have a hangover, I'd know what the word is for a shortened version of another word. Abbreviation. Thank you, Kieran. Because association football, apparently, they say the sock comes from the sock in association football. There you go. I wonder how many listeners we lost in that last little exchange. Jacob Frick has a question, talking of US people. Jacob says, the football team at my college in the US, Marquette University, just had its most successful season in some years. Well done. Several of the players on the team are from European countries and began their careers in the academies of clubs in Germany, Sweden, Italy and England. What level of salary could an academy graduate make on their first contract, assuming they continue to be a developmental player? For comparison, the tuition for Marquette, a private university, is about $44,000 a year. Would more players be better off financially seeking a scholarship? It's an interesting one, this, Kieran, because in the sort of late 80s, early 90s, it was quite the thing for players here who didn't make it at any significant level to go to the States and work as a coach or play football for an American college.
Yes. I think there's still a trickle that do take that particular route. In terms of the expectations of a first year scholar, if you're an academy scholar in League One or League Two, you're not going to be on significant money. I did some ferreting around, and they seem to indicate that the money would be, you know, similar to what you'd get as an apprentice electrician or carpenter or somebody sort of learning a trade. So you might get, you know, $6,000 or $7,000 a year. Even at Liverpool, because I think they have been concerned that some academy players at other clubs, I'm not saying Liverpool are amongst these, were somewhat blinded by the large sums of money they were earning. They had a cap of £40,000 a year for academy players. And at the age of 16 or 17, £40,000 a year. When you know, especially if you're local, the chances are you're living with your mum and dad. Yeah, that is pretty impressive. But the opportunities for somebody to go across and earn some money are not so bad. But I think they would have to be scholarship based, because there's no way you're going to be paying your own tuition fees at that level. It does. I mean, I've just said $9,500 a year is wrong in this country. I'm a believer in free education, because it's an investment in your future and the country benefits as well. Because if you go on to earn more money, then you get taxed on the back of that, and it's a win-win deal. But that's my lefty soapbox, apparently, rant for the morning. So yeah, $4,000 to $7,000 for a League One or League Two scholar. Seems to be about the going rate. You can see why people might be tempted to go to the US and seek alternatives.
I'm debating whether to join you on the lefty soapbox, Kieran. But the more education anybody gets, the better it must be for the society they live in. I can only assume education, just in general, should be a good thing, Kieran, and it should be free and available to everybody, shouldn't it? That sounds like quite a radical thing to say when you say it out loud, but it's nonsense. Of course it should be. And talking of education, I apologise to Yanisio Philippe. I'm trying to launch into that. I hope that's how you pronounce it, Yanisio. If I'm wrong, please tell me. Yanisio Philippe says, an interesting question. Slightly left field. Can English football clubs receive donations from their fans? I don't mean donations for club fundraisers. I'm referring to giving £5 to your club and then they can use it for anything they want, like wages, transfers, buying water, etc. It was the third part of that threw me a little bit when I first saw it. The wages and transfers bit I got, but then the buying water bit. So, but yeah, could I donate £5 to Palace so they can buy some more water?
Yes, you can, as can anybody. I've got the accounts of even some famous clubs, like Manchester United, going back years and years and years, when they used to receive donations from supporters' clubs. And indeed, if you look at the accounts of a few clubs, that is still something which we see on a collective basis. So that's really? That's not the club doing the fundraising, that's the fans themselves. And if you think about what happened last year during lockdown, we had this amazing desire for the game to survive from fans who were entitled to refunds on season tickets, and some even knew that the season was highly likely to not take place, and they said no, I want to be able to support Tranmere Rovers or Accrington or Morecambe or Motherwell or wherever the club is going to be in a few years' time, and therefore I'm going to effectively donate my season ticket money to the club because I'm in a financial position where I can do so the club plays such a central part to my life so yes, that their individual donations can be received. I think it's the easiest way to do that is probably to get something in return. Just go along to buy a bit more merchandise and the club's receiving money.
Yeah, we're recording this on Saturday morning, and I quite like the idea that this afternoon, when I'm donating £5 several times for a pint of lager flavoured drink, that Steve Parish goes, "Oh, brilliant! I'll buy some water with that money."
Yes.
Jake Pitt has asked us a question.
Which is great.
It's perfect, as it makes no sense whatsoever. It comes out of nowhere. It's totally illogical. So it's perfectly fitting for this podcast. It's almost the most appropriate question this podcast has ever asked. Jake Pitt says, earlier this year, Jordan Belfort, actor of Wolf of Wall Street fame, tweeted, "Whole city," and then a kind of inquiring emoji, seeming to imply that he might be interested in buying the club. Given we've all seen Wolf of Wall Street, my question is, would he have a hope in hell of passing the owner and director's test? Would financial crimes committed abroad or general debauchery preclude someone from buying a club? Jake, off the top of my head, if fictional characters were allowed to buy football clubs, I suspect there may be some kind of questions. I don't know. If Lord Voldemort wanted to buy Brighton, I think questions might be asked. I don't know if Scrooge wanted to buy a palace. I don't know, but I think we should answer the question, Kieran, in the spirit in which it was asked.
Well, first of all, Jordan Belfort is a real person.
Oh, is he? I know he is.
Yes.
He's an actor, isn't he?
No. He is the Wolf of Wall Street.
Ah, well, that entirely negates my whole premise then. So it's actually a quite logical question.
It is and it isn't. I says, would financial crimes committed abroad preclude somebody from buying a football club? No, it wouldn't, provided your convictions are spent, i.e., you have served your period in the clink. And Jordan Belfort was subject to a 4-year sentence at the end of the last century for what I've just been reading this morning as a pump and dump scam. Where investors lost £200 million or $200 million, and he then sort of claimed to be a semi-reformed character and became a public speaker and a mentor. And then if you continue following his life, he's subsequently been accused of some form of training scam, i.e., you know, I don't know whether he's giving courses on how to beat the market. And there's this has taken place in Australia. But the rules in respect of owners and directors tests are as follows. If you are a criminal who has a present conviction, even if you're out on parole or something like that, not parole. If you've been released, but you're still subject to monitoring, then you wouldn't be allowed to buy a football club. If the crimes committed are in certain areas, so such as to do with sexually related crimes, I think that could be more difficult, if not impossible. But in terms of general debauchery, I give you West Ham, because where did their owners earn their money from? And this isn't a criticism, because, you know, as I've freely admitted, I used to work in that industry myself. David Gold and David Sullivan both have made part of their fortune through the adult entertainment industry, which does involve debauchery.
Yeah, does it? I would probably argue it's quite a long way from sex toys to debauchery, but I don't know where the line lies. I did not know. Do you know what? I'm going to blame my lack of basic research on The Hangover, but even if I'd been completely sober, I still wouldn't have done any research and would have thought that The Wolf of Wall Street was it's based on a real person. Who knew that? I didn't know that was a thing in films. They're actually making films based on real people now.
Yeah, it was. He wrote the book. And
well, my goodness.
And he did say that the royalties of the book were going to be given to the people who had lost money through his investment scams, but that doesn't necessarily seem to have been the case. There's a bit of a question mark over that. I'll say no more.
Well, also, I hope I never meet the real Lord Voldemort then. I had no idea that was... I thought it was all made up. Well, crikey. David Heron has a question. How do the finances of South American club football compare to Europe, and in particular England? We all know championship clubs lose millions as they risk almost everything to get into the Premier League. I imagine most football fans are aware of the bigger teams in Argentina and Brazil, so that might be a good place to start.
Brazil is concerned, a Serie A club in their top division is earning around about £50 million a year. So, yeah, that's going to be at the a club towards the top end of the championship. Leeds were around about making that money. It's about the same amount of money that Rangers or Celtic would be receiving. So that sort of benchmarks the Brazilian league. And it's three times bigger than clubs in Argentina. They're on around about £15 million a year. So, yeah, lower end of the championship. It's actually the same as clubs in Saudi Arabia earn, which surprised me, because I didn't know that football was as big in Saudi as that. And then the third biggest league in South America, and I'm excluding Mexico here because even on my basic geography tells me that Mexico is deemed to be Central America rather than South, would be Colombia. And there we're talking around about £7 million a year, which is the equivalent of a half-decent League One club. They are considerably smaller than the Premier League, but compared to, we were talking about, Belgium and the Netherlands, they're still probably bigger than quite a few clubs in those leagues, in Portugal and so on.
I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
From South America to somewhere slightly less exotic, unless you live there, in which case I apologise. Richard Proctor has a question concerning Ipswich Town, who are now primarily owned by an investment fund. The club was purchased for a reported £40 million, and currently being in League One, it will probably cost them at least that again to even get into the top half of the Championship. Add to this the losses the club made over the period of Marcus Evans' ownership. I can't work out how this is a logical investment for a fund that ultimately needs to make a return. It's an interesting question. We spoke to the new owners of Ipswich Town, who were very bullish about making money from the club.
Yes. Yeah, I think Richard's got a fair point here. As you rightly said, Brett Johnson kindly came on the show shortly after he bought the club, and he's very enthusiastic and has ambitions for Ipswich Town. They were losing around about £15 million a year on a regular basis in the Championship, and they were in the Championship for a long period of time. Marcus Evans plugged all of those gaps, which weren't made by player sales, and player sales helped to cover for some of them. But I think Richard's correct. Getting into the Premier League is tricky, and that's the only way that the Brett Johnson and the club is also partially owned by an American pension fund. It's the only way they're going to make the money. Get to the Premier League and then you flip the club, that you sell it on to somebody else. And if you do sell it on the club that's just been promoted to the Premier League, you're probably looking at somewhere in the region of 150 million. So if I was, as you know, I don't gamble, but I do look at probabilities, and what's the probability of Ipswich Town getting to the Premier League in, let's say, the next 5 years? Probably less than 10%.
Nil. Yeah, let's be bold here. Let's say nil. They don't seem likely to be in the Premier League in 5 years. When you manage a pension fund, Kieran, and of course you're responsible therefore for the futures of hundreds of thousands, millions of people maybe. Is there a legal criteria about the things you can invest in? Because you have to get a return for your money, surely, don't you? It's not just an individual taking a punt thinking I might get a couple of quid out of this. If you're managing money on behalf of other people, surely there must be a legal legal sort of criteria with what you do with the money, is there?
You have a responsibility from an ethical and governance point of view. And what you would always try to do is to acquire what they would refer to as a balanced portfolio, which will contain a mix of short, medium, and high risk investments. Where if you'd invested in Tesla a decade ago, that would now be turning a very good return, but it comes at a high risk. You'd also be investing in those industries which pay out every year, but are spectacularly dull. Things such as water companies. Everybody uses water. They pay out relatively low returns, but still higher than you potentially get from sticking the money in a bank. So it's all a case of having a balanced approach, and no one person tends to be in charge of the pension fund. You'll have a series of fund managers who will be looking at domestic markets, overseas markets, utilities, different industries, and so on. These people do tend to work pretty crazy hours, but in the long run, it's difficult to beat the market. There's lots of people can do it on a short term basis. But doing it on a long-term basis is very difficult indeed. Warren Buffett has become one of the world's richest men by taking such backing himself, but he's very much the exception.
Right, Warren Buffett's a real person as well.
Yes.
Unfortunately, Kieran, as my current state can attest, not everybody uses water. Our next question comes from Phil Chater, and Phil says, over several pods, which is quite true, you've mentioned image rights. When these rights are talked about, it seems always to be covering the top players. My question is, how far down the league would image rights be used?
I think realistically, Phil, it's going to be in the Premier League and perhaps some clubs in the Championship as well, because who is ultimately going to be using the image rights? It's going to be commercial partners and sponsors. So if you are a League Two club, and no disrespect to Rochdale and Cambridge United and clubs in the lower leagues and Morecambe and so on, how many people are going to go to the club and say, we desperately want to use your left back for a campaign? If you're Cristiano Ronaldo, you've got 300 million followers on Instagram. If you are a previous academy player who's just come through for a League One or League Two club, you're not going to have sufficient gravitas or sufficient visual awareness from a viewer's point of view to attract a huge amount of interest. So I don't think that image rights would be significant, if anything at all. There could be a nominal reference to them in a contract, but that's only because the chances are you're signing a central contract which has been issued by the club to all of its staff. They might want the captain to go along, but even so, he might get a small benefit from the commercial partner, and that's as far as it goes.
In an example, yet another example of why TV drama should never try and cover football, a recent episode of Endeavour, the detective series set in the late 60s, early 70s, covered a death threat against a footballer and talked a lot about image rights and his glamorous lifestyle and his agent and the money he was earning from general fashion stuff, which was wrong anyway because it was the 1960s, early 70s, but also the fact that he played for Oxford Wanderers.
No.
In front of, and the death threat was to try and stop him playing in a lucrative cup tie against Cowley Town in front of what looked like four people. I just laughed all the way through the whole. Ali loves that program, so she got crossed. that I was laughing all the way through the 2 hours of this chap playing for Oxford Wanderers in 1970 talking about his image rights.
That's an
entirely appropriate response to that little diversion was, you're right, Kieran. Our last question on it's a mercifully short pod today comes from, if we get too professional at any time, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, please do let us know. Adam Manning has a question now. And Adam says, I think I can predict the answer to this question. Adam says, now that Sutton United are in the Football League, what is the impact financially, open brackets question to Kieran, close brackets, and locally, open brackets question to Kevin, close brackets, on the nearby existing league clubs? With Plough Lane and Sellers Park being nearby, will those clubs see a loss of fans to Gander Green Lane, or is the existence of a new local rival going to have a minimal impact on their bottom line? Well, I would, certainly from Palace's point of view, I would tick the minimal impact box, to be perfectly honest. It's lovely to see a local club like Sutton in the Football League. It's probably more annoying for their fans that they get patronised by Palace fans going, it's lovely to see them in the Football League. But I can't see any minimal impact on our bottom line, or indeed Wimbledon's. If anything, there's an impact on Sutton's bottom line in that fans of Wimbledon and Palace might be tempted to go along when their teams are playing away.
Yes, I mean, if we take a look at the finances of Sutton United in the most recent season in the National League, they lost $200,000. Their crowds have gone up this season in League Two, which is fantastic. They're averaging over 3,000.
Yeah.
That will be, I think there'll be a curiosity value. Those fans that perhaps used to go and watch them a few times a season might watch them a few times more. But I think the other issue, and here is Football Trainspotter talking, all of the other clubs in League Two, the fans there think new away ground.
Yeah.
So there tends to be a first season bounce. And we saw that with Gary Neville's Salford City when they first went up to League Two. But they now have the lowest average attendances in that division. Because once you've ticked off that ground, you go, well, do I want to go to Salford this weekend, or why don't you go and stay and watch Jeff Stelling instead? And that's the decision that you have to make. So there tends to be that first season bounce and then a tapering off. It's great that they're getting higher crowds. They're getting more money because they're entitled to the EFL TV deal and the solidarity payments from the Premier League. But in terms of the impact on AFC and Palace, absolutely zero. Because also, you're Palace till you die. So you're not going to... unless something does happen, which is, as we saw with FC United of Manchester and the Glazer takeover. And we've seen from the very occasional Newcastle fan with regards to the Saudi Arabian takeover, where you feel that that the club no longer represents your values, then you're gonna always support your club. You're right. You said you might pop along and see them because they're playing such and such this week. That sounds like quite a good game. Or you might go and see them in the first round of the FA Cup, and so on. But that's as far as it goes from your perspective as a fan of your club.
Well, that's the thing. It's one of those things where you're desperate for them to get through to the third round of the FA Cup because you want to draw them in the same way we're all desperate to get Burton Albion in the FA Cup because we've never played them before.
And you just want to go. It's a great, great place to go to. We've been there once. Fantastic.
I wouldn't know, Kieran. We've never had an occasion to go there. It's also much further north than I thought it was. It's an interesting example of how effective the pyramid is, though, because when I was growing up, Sutton and Wimbledon was a very, very big rivalry, but in the Southern League, as it was in, you never dreamed that those two clubs would end up in the Football League, but yet here they are. So it does illustrate that it's perfectly possible for a club down at that level to get into the hallowed 92.
Yeah, spot on.
Yep. Thank you to everybody who's made a donation to the pod via our Patreon site. I suspect after today's farrago, we may not be getting many donations this week, but if you would like to make a small monthly contribution to the pod, then go to patreon.com/priceoffootball. And if you have a question you'd like answered on the show, then please email us at questions@priceandfootball.com. Before I hand over to Kieran, I shall pause only to say, in my brief relationship with Kieran, I've often wondered what it's like to be teetotal. And now I really, really wonder what it's like to be teetotal. And you know what, Kieran, I might try it for a couple of weeks. It must be lovely. So I'll hand you over to Mr. Kieran Maguire, perfectly headache-free, for his customary farewell.
Well, I did actually drink alcohol once. I've drunk it once in my life.
What?
I'd just been dumped. I think I'd just been dumped by a girlfriend. Ooh. And she'd torn a strip off me. You know, she sort of told me what a complete waste of space I was. I was feeling a bit sorry myself, and she'd come round with a bottle of red wine. Ooh. And she sort of got one glass into it and then decided that, you know, she'd been building this up to say, right, Kieran, you're a waste of space. And so I was feeling a bit upset. It's sometimes it's not nice to learn the truth. No. So I thought, okay, I'm going to give it a go. Yeah. And I'm in my mid-20s at this stage. So I take a sip and I go, Jesus Christ, this tastes foul. How on earth can anybody drink it? So I had a bottle of Orangina that's how I used to drink in those days. So I thought, right, I'm going to give it a go, and I mixed the red wine with Orangina and managed to get through most of the rest of the bottle. I go, this really isn't doing it for me, and I felt terrible. I felt absolutely terrible. And then I woke up many hours later with this absolutely banging headache. Oh, God, this is a nightmare. This is the worst thing that's ever happened to me. I don't know how I got into the bed, but managed to get into the bed, pulled back the bedspread, and my lower regions had turned bright orange. And I'm going, Jesus Christ, it's the effect of the red wine and the Orangina on me. And I go, this is a nightmare. And then I spotted that lying by the side of the bed was a copy of Razzle and a bag of cheesy Watsits, which clearly had been combined in my self-pity earlier in the previous evening. And that's it. I've not been near it since.
I don't blame you, Kieran, if that was your first experience. I mean, I've had to force myself to drink cheap red wine on occasions, but I'm still trying to work out how the cheesy Watsits and the Razzle combined to turn you into an Oompa Loompa. But there you are. But having said that, I've now written down red wine, Orangina, ? Because that's kind of homemade sangria.
Oh, is it?
That's not a bad idea. But it's in alcohol's favour, Kieran. It did take your mind off the fact that you had been dumped the night before, clearly.
Yes, indeed.
And also, in my defence, Kieran, I've only drunk once in my life, but it's just over 45 years. Thank you for listening, everybody. We'll see you next week when we'll both be back on the professional sober as anything. So hungover I couldn't even think of the right analogy for being sober next time, Kieran. There you are.
Following all this, if you would like to vote for us in Football Supporters Association Awards, we are up for Best Online Media. We don't know what it means either, but if you vote for us, we could find out if you give us the award. We can go up on the stage and say, Would you mind telling us what we've just won? And how it sounds?
Well, we've been invited. That's a good sign.
We have. Yes, we have.
It's just a question of finding out. It's when you turn up at these things and your table is next to the toilet. You think, I've not won this, have I? As when I was nominated for a BAFTA for Best Writer and I lost to Sound of Music.
No.
It's lost to Sound of Music stage production that was on once. So at least I lost to something decent, but I wasn't happy. Yeah. I was happy because it was the day we beat Watford in the semi-final of the FA Cup. So I turned up happy. Let's just say, Kieran, that the day after I felt even worse than I feel at the moment. Let's just leave it there. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
The price of football. The price of football.